What you just heard was the Jackson 5. I'm sure you're all familiar. Never Can Say Goodbye. I think that's coming from their fifth album, maybe tomorrow. Obviously, Michael is a big
hot upcoming band.
Yeah, it's an upcoming boy band. Michael's big in the news right now for obvious reasons, and I'm finding the reactions to the film to be really interesting. Now, it's not one I've seen. I think I'm going to wait till VOD, and I'll check it out there. I have a number of complicated feelings in regards to the film and in regards to the participants and what I feel like would be the weight and gravitas that the story of Michael should be given. I just didn't really feel like it was going to dive that deep into the psyche of what, you know, made Michael Michael. And it feels like, based on the critiques, I was right in what a lot of people are saying. Now, what I think is interesting, or what's an interesting point, is a lot of the detractors were being, rounded up and classified as, it just didn't handle the allegations after the 88 trial, or after the year of 88. But I feel like that's just one critique, and not a very loud one. There's been several great pieces written about why this film, and why I could tell, just even based on the marketing material, that it's going to be lacking. And it sure as shit, when it came out, I just knew it. You just knew. But that's not to say, if you want to go see a movie that highlights the genius of Michael, the music, this film is going to offer that for that audience. And I think it's very, if that's the kind of film you want, if you kind of want a more of the standard biopic and we're just kind of rushing the songs. In my past, there's a film we grew up with called Jackson 5, The American Dream. It's really popular on MTV or BET, one of those channels back in the day. It's about a 4-hour film, and it really kind of more holistically covers the Jackson family and their rise from rags to riches. One of the pivotal scenes in there, I'm not sure if it's covered, because what I hear is that the brothers aren't really featured. They're more extras in the film. Jermaine, Michael, Marlon, that's a pretty defined trio there, and how they kind of survived Joe. If you know anything about Michael and him growing up, they were fairly close. And so Jermaine ending up staying with Motown while the family moves on is a real pivotal part in that family, like their dynamic and where they move forward with their careers. And Never Can Say Goodbye, I'm a little long-winded here, but Never Can Say Goodbye is how we handle that shift from the Jacksons kind of growing out of being the child boy band into more of the adults and where that kind of goes. So it's a film that I think we will cover sometime in the life of this podcast. If I wasn't so committed to Godfather later on in the year for Families Eat Their Own, I would maybe put on Jackson 5, The American Dream. That could be a really interesting one too. So when I think of a story that handles the weight of it a little better, it's going to be hard for me to be the predecessor. But I am curious to see it. I don't know if I'm going to, put the money. I'd rather catch it on VOD, put it like that. So
yeah.
That's Never Can Say Goodbye. I'm going to toss it to McGee for his pick.
Yeah, so this is the track that you're about to hear coming out is, I don't honestly even really know how to say the name of the band. It's Angine de Poitrine. I just call them Angry Poutine. I saw one comment called them Slipdot, which made me laugh very hard. We've talked a bit about previously, like specifically with musicians, like having that sort of like visual aesthetic sort of like bit that you do as being a good way to hook an audience and like build a following. And this is a band that has existed for some time. I'm not sure how long they've been together, but they're just blowing up right now. And it's interesting to see, because it is like this, I think, like right now, even when I Googled him, the Google page just had polka dots all over the screen, like one of those like Easter eggs that they do. So they're a Canadian band. I believe they're from Quebec. I almost said Montreal. I would have started a fight there. It's just a two piece. The guitarist, he plays like a double like bass guitar, and then uses loop pedals and effects pedals to like slowly build the song over the course of the track, which is something that I'm just specifically a bit of a sucker for. I haven't really seen, there's been some, you know, like Reggie Watts, you know, got big doing this. Toon Yards, who's a Boots Riley's like go-to musical artist, specifically in the new trailer. I don't know if you watched that.
I did, yeah.
Toon Yards is the band that he always uses for his soundtracks now. Mm. And they did a similar thing where that was like their kind of primary hook focus, where that it was mostly just this one artist like building a song out of adding like vocal loops, like, and using your voice as an instrument and slowly using that to go from a really bare bones thing into like an incredibly textured, chaotic, layered of all these loops that slowly build up. It feels a lot like a magician like showing you how they're doing the magic trick and then pulling off the magic trick anyway.
Oh, okay.
Of like, you're hearing how simple and chaotic and like off kilter some of the hooks and riffs and beats are, and then when everything finally gets layered together and you're just fucking jamming with it, it's like, I never thought we would get here from how much it hurt to like hold all of those rhythms at once when they finally coalesce into something that's just a fucking jam. But yeah, absolutely fantastic band. I've been really enjoying it.
Yeah,
I was curious to hear what your thoughts are on it, but it sounds like you didn't listen to it.
Yeah, time got away from me, but I'll hear it in the edit, great. And we'll cover that and some more in Shooting Shit coming up after this. Right, this is Ian McGee shooting the shit about the ish they're effing with. And on today's episode, we have Hokum coming from Damian McCarthy, starring Adam Scott. We got Crime 101, the Chris Hemsworth vehicle. We got The Running Man, talking a little Glenn Powell. And then we'll end the episode with Comics Corner. Got an interesting short film that crossed my timeline I want to talk about. And catching up on Martian Manhunter series. So we'll get started here with Hokum from 2026.
First time in Ireland.
My folks
came here for their honeymoon. Always wanted to come back.
Why didn't they?
I don't know if you've noticed, but there are some oddballs walking around this place.
There are worse things than strangers out there, Yank.
One of the members of staff is missing.
What about the honeymoon suite?
It's always locked.
I'm getting a weird feeling. Something feels off.
Jesus.
All right, that was from the trailer of Hokum. This is directed by Damian McCarthy, starring Adam Scott, Peter Coonan, and David Wilmot. Logline from IMDb, a horror writer visits an Irish inn to scatter his parents' ashes, unaware that the property is said to be haunted by a witch. Damian McCarthy, I think this is his third feature. He might have done other ones beyond that, but the third, like, kind of pop, like, widely released feature. He did Caveat in 2020 and Oddity in 2024. Both of them were produced by Shudder Originals. Shout out Shudder. And Hokum was just released widely this month, I think. It came out, premiered in March at South by Southwest. This is a filmmaker. I know some of my friends that are more into horror have definitely been excited for Damian McCarthy. I've heard, you know, some murmurs about him before. Then Natalie was excited to see Hokum, and so we went out to see it last weekend, and it's interesting. I don't know that you would watch it. Obviously, it's a horror movie, so I know you wouldn't be on your radar in general. I don't think that I'll force you to watch this one. I did enjoy it quite a bit, but I'll try and keep this spoiler-free just for the audience sake for the most part, but I'm not anticipating you going out and seeking this one out. There are a handful of jump scares, but what's really interesting to me about this movie and about Damian McCarthy's work in general that I've kind of visited since watching it is he does a really interesting mix of supernatural and mundane horror where everything feels very believable and there's just a little bit of supernatural stuff sprinkled in, but it's not done in a way. I feel like there's a lot of times where movies try to do that where they make the bulk of it mundane, like the real horror is man. But the supernatural stuff is used to, like, advance the plot, where this movie doesn't feel like it relies on anything out of the ordinary to make sense of the sequence of events, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Like, it's very logical and straight, almost to the point where it feels almost like video gamey. Like, the protagonist is competent and making wise choices, and the plot unfolds, like, kind of regardless of him making some of the correct moves. Obviously, not entirely and, like, not emotionally. Like, there's a good arc there. But I just found it interesting. It didn't rely on so many of the same old, like, people being dumb in order to put them in the place where the plot can make them vulnerable to the next thing that needs to happen in order to make things dramatic. Like, this is very much gets the drama out of, like, okay, you solved that problem. Now you're in a new situation. Now what? Which is was a bit refreshing. I would really enjoy, because I went back and watched his first film, Caveat, from 2020, and that was somewhat similar, the bulk of the plot of the movie is, like, there's, like, the main character is, like, an amnesiac, and he gets hired to look after this girl on a remote island, and then, like, spoiler, you know, fast forward past this segment if you don't want to hear any more spoilers for Caveat or Hokum. But in Caveat, it's revealed that, like, the main character has amnesia because he was, like, a co-conspirator in a murder, and then they tried to, like, kill him. They pushed him out a window or something to cover it up, and then he survived. And so they lure him back to the island to, like, finish the job. And also the island's haunted. It's like, that's kind of how his plots work in general. It's like, the movie would entirely make sense if you removed the supernatural element. But the supernatural element is just kind of added into it as a little extra spice. But it's a totally, like, not structurally... It's braided in there so that it's integral, but it's not reliant on it to advance the plot forward. Like, everything still works without the supernatural element, which I find really interesting.
I'm curious with Hokum. You mentioned he's a writer, right? Was he? Did that factor into the plot at all? Or is that, like, the supernatural element where it doesn't necessarily, you could remove that element and he's still kind of going through his journey? Because I didn't hear anything about, like, It's not like, what is it, Lady in the Water or whatever, when fucking Paul Giamatti's like writing.
Yeah.
Like, is it that kind of thing where he's writing and the horror is getting more scary as he's getting deeper into the novel?
Not really, no. There's a little bit of, like, there's the bookend framing device of, like, he's trying to figure out how to end this, like, series of books that he's been working on. And so people are like, when they recognize who he is, they immediately want to know how the ending is. Mm. Like, they're like, oh, how are you going to write yourself out of this one? Which is kind of mirroring the movie in general, because he's constantly, like, coming up with a way to legitimately, like, make a smart decision to move forward out of whatever situation he's in. And he's just still getting in progressively worse scenarios. And so it is like, oh, how are you going to write yourself out of this one? Is kind of the general vibe of the movie. But it's not as tied in as like Lady in the Water, but because it's like mostly a murder mystery, mm-hmm. even like in Caveat, it feels like he's like doing more of like a trying to be like, I can see like early shades of like Baby Nolan.
Oh, okay.
From like
The Following or, what was it?
Yeah. We're just
Antarctica one or not the Antarctica, the Alaska one.
Insomnia or whatever.
Something of that nature.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because it's like they're, especially as the production level like increases, you can kind of see, I feel like he's got the horror like vibe in him, in his heart, but I would put money on his next film being way less horror related and just being more of a straightforward like thriller, or you know, getting picked up to do some part of something like bigger or whatever. But there's just too much. He's too good at braiding everything else together and then adding that horror in as a spice, mm-hmm. where I could see him even in the way that like, who's the Aquaman? James Wan.
I thought you were talking about Momoa, but yeah, James Wan.
The way that like James Wan kind of like went from that like really stylized horror into like popcorn shit.
Okay.
Not that I think McCarthy's going to do that, but I think it'll be interesting to see where he goes from here. Adam Scott does a great job too. Adam Scott, surprisingly, I think he's got some, you know, I've seen some like media that he's been putting out for this movie coming out. Where it's like, oh yeah, he was in Hellraiser. I think it was Hellraiser 4.
3.
And he gets killed off. He auditions for Hellraiser 6. Something like that. But it's like
I saw the, what you're talking about. Yeah.
It was just fucking hilarious. Very very fucking Hollywood ass story of like, maybe they won't know that I'm already in this.
Said he needed the money. That's hilarious.
It happens.
All right, so that was Hokum. Is that still in theaters at the time of the recording of this podcast?
Yeah, definitely still in theaters. Go check it out if you can. I think Oddity is his second movie, is streaming on Hulu, Disney Plus. And then Caveat, I rented it on YouTube and, you know, usual places.
All right, check it out. And I'm going to move on to another thriller, Crime 101, coming up after this.
Mike.
Sharon, so what are we driving?
If you can guess, I'll give you the keys to it.
Ooh, Chevy Chevelle, racing green.
Right color.
That is a beautiful car. I need to be in your line of work. I'm real good at reading people.
And what have you read about me?
Okay. You look like a person who has secrets. You got the cars, the clothes, but you can't seem to look me in the eye.
Start by handing me your phone.
You're looking at robberies of jewels, money, or high-value items in the last 4 years. Now, remove every robbery where there was DNA left at the scene.
I think all of these are the same guy, and he hits every time. Along the 101 freeway.
I came here to make you a business proposition. I've worked at the same company for 11 years. You're a VP when you should be a partner. Those high-value items your company insures, I occasionally make them disappear. And no one gets hurt.
I wouldn't die for an insurance company. Get in. There's water in the trunk.
There's a courier carrying watches and gems. And the buyer is paying cash. Looking at $11 million in one room. Three of which I'll be taking.
Doesn't matter how much money you make, it's never enough.
I'll know when I have enough.
How?
He's planning something new, Father.
My dad always said you gotta break a few eggs.
You tell him I see you again in the book.
Yeah.
All right, so that was from Crime 101. Here's a log line. It's a little lengthy, so bear with me here. Here's a log line. Set against the sun-bleached grit of Los Angeles, a thief whose high-stakes heist along the iconic 101 freeway mystify police. When he eyes the score of a lifetime, he hopes this will be his final job. His path collides with a disillusioned insurance broker who is facing her own crossroads, forcing the two to collaborate with a relentless detective in tow. This is directed by Bart Layton. This is photographed by Eric Wilson. This is written by Bart Layton based on the novella by Don Wilson of the same name. Don's pretty popular on social media platforms. And he's a bit of a film fan. So I didn't realize, as I'm watching this, that this was a Don story. But, all right. So Crime 101, this is like the ideal Dumpy pick for me. It's a really tight, well-placed thriller, and obviously those are my favorites. So the manner in which this one starts, I think, is really interesting because there's not so much that you can do with a crime thriller that we haven't already seen before. What do we have? Heat.
Yeah. The L.A. heist might as well be its own genre beyond just heist.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's only, I mean, we've seen it all. So the way in which this one is handled, there's going to be minor spoilers for the first 30 seconds of the film. We use LA as a backdrop and we go like upside down with a soft focus opening that twists right side up with the mantra of breathing or a woman reminding us to breathe. We start to touch on how like disorienting LA is, just the nature of it, the town itself, and we heal through this mantra and camera movement. And I think there are a number of inventive hooks that keep the crime fans engaged, and a number of interesting threads and cinephile touches that keep those in a films literate city like LA kind of interested too. So plenty of like, you know, damn, that was interesting. How they, you know, how did you handle it that way? Or I wouldn't have thought to handle something in that way. And transitioning through traffic as we pass one another and passing off the story is one of those ways that I liked a lot. This has a fantastic opening heist, like based on LA crime classics. Like they break the rule of not showing your characters getting up in the morning, which I think a few filmmakers have actually done this really interesting. Like we saw David Fincher in The Killer, and how he shows his character getting ready for his day is actually really fascinating. Because very few of us are assassins, so watching an assassin kind of get ready for, you know, his job, his day is kind of an interesting thing. I
like that you corrected yourself so as to not offend assassins.
Oh, I wasn't offended. I was actually correcting myself because I was going to say.
I was making a joke.
I see what you say. I got you. So we see two really normal people getting up for their day, Mark Ruffalo, Halle Berry, and then you see a really abnormal outlier getting up for his day. And I think the contrast of all three was a really interesting way to kind of not only state that we're going to have three, you know, separate threads going on, but also, you know, how they combine is another.
Yeah.
Interesting bit. The solid performances all the way around. And Barry Keoghan, I think, kind of like steals the show a little bit. Like, he actually, we had a talk earlier when with Matt Reeves, the Batman, and our thoughts on Joker. I'd be hard pressed to remember exactly where we landed on that. I wasn't exactly excited to see that version of the Joker, but seeing him.
No,
in this
I hated
film,
it.
Did
yeah.
you hate it? Yeah. Is that where yeah. we landed on that?
I mean, I know that's where I landed.
Yeah, I may have softened a little bit if I were on that train. Was that 2 years ago, 3 years ago? But I think Barry as a performer is super super interesting in this one, and he like makes me almost want to see what his Joker will be. He plays, you know, he does another patented unhinged, you know, performance, and it reminds me a little bit of like Caleb Landry Jones, the character we covered in. Get Out, the brother, that kind of energy, and then kind of made me think. I was like, "What's going on with Caleb? I wonder what he's up to." Because it seems like he can kind of play these similar roles that Barry's getting.
Yeah,
but it was a It was really...
I mean, Barry's got to be crazy to cheat on fucking Sabrina Carpenter, an idiot.
Yeah. I don't listen either. I don't know the personal relationships of either, so I'd be a hard person to say.
I'm just making it a bit, yeah.
But Halle Berry is like an older woman on the edge. I think is another interesting bit too. Halle's been in our lives for forever, so we're seeing her get to this place, and you know, as the older matriarch of Hollywood, and sort of dealing with that. And she sees an opportunity to turn her misfortune here as a kind of career burnout into you know, opportunity to make millions. So I think seeing her play with that and what she does with a sort of an aging beauty movie star, not that she's any less beautiful today, but kind of hearing her like, or seeing how she's addressing that in this film was really interesting too. This, and it also led to one of the scenes where I actually like nodded and smiled, and Halle delivered it in the only the way that she can. And before I get to the main act, I want to talk about Nick Nolte as well. He's back in this one. We covered his performance in Cape Fear. So if you've seen that film, please join us with that episode. He's still in some...
Which they're remaking, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. We talked about it that in that episode, too. It's Javier Bardem is going to take on the, the Nick Nolte role. Or not the Nick Nolte role, the De Niro role.
The De Niro role, yeah.
And... here, Nick Nolte is in somewhat still like degenerate form, but it was nice to see him anyway. And what's really, I'm not sure if this is a vocal tic that he was performing, or if he's actually kind of suffering a little bit from his something going on with his vocal performance. But he has a really interesting take on the voice on this one, and then I think he still kind of commands the screen, and there's still a presence there even with this kind of vocal tic. And it says a little bit about the character that I thought was really interesting. And I think Hemsworth, like, all the action nailed. Like he's the action B movie dumpy weary kind of guy that I like seeing. Like I'm a big I love the Netflix I can't even think of the title of the
Extraction or whatever.
Extraction, the series, yeah. But I enjoy him in some of these, you know, B movie action roles. I do think he's asked to do like a socially awkward bit for his character here that is maybe a little less successful. Like he's a sort of a devout loner that's looking for love, and I found those bits to be a little less successful. But I think overall the actual performance is really solid. And we get another Mark Ruffalo cop. I mean, long before the Green Painter Marvel and those purple shorts, like Ruffalo made a steady living in the hair mused and in trench coat parts of Cops and like Collateral and Zodiac and
he's
Shutter
either
Island.
Mm-hmm. Collateral, Shutter Island, fucking Now You See Me. How many other movies? If he's not a cop, he's a lawyer and or a reporter, some sort of disgruntled suit wearing motherfucker.
Right. So he's doing the cop here, but there's more of a cop that's. Has a self-aware history of Ruffalo being in these parts, so there's a little something different at the end there that I found kind of fun for if you're in the know for the Ruffalo parts. So that's Crime 101. I would recommend No Qualifications. I think it's a really adrenaline rush, a fun tight thriller, solid performances all the way around, and somewhat a little underwhelming at the end there, but well worth checking out. And it's available right now on Amazon Prime. I would say check it out. So I'm gonna move on. All right, I'm going to move on to my last bit, The Running Man, another film available on Amazon Prime, and we'll check it out after this.
Ben Richards, 35, married, one child, in medical crisis.
We need money for a doctor now.
Ben, watch us up.
Employment status, blacklisted. But there's still a way out for you. It's the biggest show in the country.
Bloodlust is our birthright! Set it free! Welcome to the Running Man!
People on these games never come back.
I'm not trying to get myself killed, so kiss my ass twice.
Right there is why you can win this game. The rules are simple. Survive 30 days with the entire nation hunting you down. And get your family out of Slumside for good.
I'm gonna come back here and burn this building down. I promise.
That's the spirit.
This is America, goddammit! And we don't put up with no bullshit! Yes!
All right, so that was from The Running Man. This is the log line. A man joins a game show in which contestants, allowed to flee anywhere in the world, are pursued by hunters hired to kill them. This is directed by Edgar Wright. This is photographed by Chung Hoon Chung. This is written by Michael Bacall and Edgar Wright, based on the Stephen King novel of the same name. This movie was everywhere last year, so I'm excited to cover it now. It was a hyperkinetic Glen Powell action romp, and it's finally available on VOD. I wanted to see this, and I wanted to see where my interest in Wright had landed, because it's sort of waned somewhat. I wasn't the biggest fan of Baby Driver, and Last Soho was marketed as sort of a horror, so I tuned out a bit. This, however, seemed more my speed, and it came up in a recent episode of Brazil. If you guys are fans of that film, please join us there. And I wanted to kind of check it out and see what the verdict is going to be. And I really found this to be an interesting watch, like a really, really fucking slick, like Edgar Wright production. Like he's such a savant, I feel like, in pacing and camera placement. And he maximizes the economy of storytelling with these techniques in a really effective way for me. I think there's definitely some like heavy-handed, little, like, you know, didactic bits here. I think generally when you're dealing with Europeans that satirize, you know, the America, they're going to put a little extra on it. So,
yeah.
I
think we kind of need that from time to time. Like, it takes, sometimes I like the intimate knowledge works for a movie, but sometimes it works against it. Like, the outside perspective on the absurdity of the American experience is sometimes what I think stuff like this exactly needs. Like Verhoeven with Starship Troopers, I think is another example of that, which is just like sometimes you need like the outside perspective to really see how ridiculous the system is. I didn't realize that Chung Chung-hoon had shot The Running Man. He's the cinematographer for Park Chan-wook on a bunch of stuff. He did fucking Old Boy way back in the day. He also did fucking It with Andy Muschietti in 2017, and so he's been doing a whole bunch of shit. So I didn't realize that he shot The Running Man too. That's an interesting pairing with Edgar Wright, like you're saying, like with the kineticism and the editing style, like kind of running off of some of his other collaborators, because it does seem like he's worked with Park Chan-wook a lot, like Lady of Vengeance and et cetera, but. He seems to be working with a bunch of new people recently. Oh, he did Last Night in Soho, too. Shit, I didn't realize that either. I didn't watch that one. Damn, I might have to watch Last Night in Soho.
Well, with this one, I think that they do pull nuance out where it counts. I myself was a part of a live studio game show audience last year, and I found the experience to be really superficial and off-putting. I think how Wright deals with that, like how he handles what it's like to have to like perform for the camera and be a different person and then manipulate those emotions. I do think he pulls out some really interesting nuance there. And so I loved every minute of that. I found the watching of this to be a little challenging. I mentioned in our Hard Target episode, if you guys are fans of that one, please join us there as well. That I may want to see this type of challenge in the real world. And I'll say, after watching this, this is a very misguided opinion, to sort of really dig through the thought experiment of that. I think the world needs to be in a very specific state to sort of allow for that kind of bloodshed on TV. So,
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's not really the reality I would want to live in. And I think as a credit to the film, they get that message through really quick. The story is really simple, and this is a Stephen King story, or based on a Stephen King story. So, in vain of a King walkabout story, characters walk until their feet bleed, and either from the road or other antagonists. And what's fun about watching this is the many different ways King and Wright can kind of make them bleed. And there's so many fun ways that we get to contort this conceit in a man running for his life, shootings and bombings and slashings and conniving and flying and suicide diving. It's all here in like really quick comedic succession. So some truly great standouts and some supporting performances I want to note here. Coleman Domingo, who's been on fire for like 2 or 3 years, plays like a heightened, bloodthirsty carnival barker. And like we have Josh Brolin here as even more depraved and soulless ringleader. And I think they were very much hamming it up and having a great time with this one. So two great key performances I'd like to check out there.
I know this movie has two of the hottest men in Hollywood right now. Well, I mean, obviously Glenn Powell is like hot in the sense of like they're trying to push him as a leading man. But Lee Pace and Coleman Domingo, I think, are the like two most attractive human beings in Hollywood right now. And that they're both in this movie is like, man, I really probably should have watched this one in theaters. So.
That's interesting. Would this have been?
I mean, I know it didn't get it kind of got bad reviews, and so it turned me off of actually seeing it. But I was 100% planning on seeing it in theater because it was like Edgar Wright, Coleman Domingo, Lee Pace. I'm there.
I think you're going to be a little disappointed with how they handle Lee Pace.
Did you watch the 80s one, like the old Arnie one?
Did I watch the old Arnie one? No, I didn't see the original one. No, not yet. No.
You've never seen the original? Shit.
Yeah.
Okay. Good to know. I'm taking note.
Speaking of Glenn Powell and the leading man here, I do think that what do I want to say? The sort of scowl and growl, I do think that he puts on here is like an angry leading man.
Is scowl and growl a term? Or did you just make that up?
No, I just made that up. Alliteration is
I scowl and growl fucking rules. Oh, yeah. I really love that. Yeah. You said that so, and I was like, if that should be a way to describe a performance already, because scowl and growl is so fucking funny. Fuck, that's really good,
that's
dude.
Hilarious. I do feel like he's very capable, but there's something, and as I'm watching this, I don't want to be too critical, but as I'm watching this, I'm getting the same sort of like
scowl and growl.
As I'm watching this, I'm getting the same sort of. Hey, so the name that we're going to cover here is actually Rajon Jean Page, or Rajay Jean Page. I apologize if I got that wrong, even the clarification. I bring that up to say that I'm looking to correlate the artificiality that I'm feeling from his performance to Glenn Powell. And just wanted to hop in here and make that clarification. He's an actor that appeared in You, Me, and Tuscany, Bridgerton, Dungeons and Dragons, and Black Bag. I've seen maybe three or four performances that just hadn't landed with me, and I'm trying to figure out why. Sean's going to jump in here with a great explanation as to what may be the case, so I'll let you guys get to that here in a second. I can't remember what it is.
Yeah, he's the Bridgerton and... I think it's like Renee. He's got three names, whatever his name is. One of his three names is Renee.
Okay.
He's like French-Canadian or something.
Yeah. Where it's... I think he's capable, but I'm not really buying it emotionally, or I'm not really feeling the bits. So when I'm seeing Glenn do the furrowed brow and the screening at the camera, I'm never really buying him as an angry man in the way that, say, I just watched our boy Enemy of the State. Your movie.
Hackman? Smith?
Hackman. Oh. I never really buy him as angry as I do Gene Hackman. Like, Hackman sells...
I mean, Hackman's the all-time great angry, but
the thing is, he's not always... It's not always furrowed brow. Like, he sells the tonalities and variations in a much more convincing way than Glenn constantly eyes furrowed, doing the scowl and growl thing. Like, he doesn't... It seems like he's... I feel him acting where Gene genuinely feels like I'm pissed off. And I'm like, I don't know what to, like, there's a leading man quality that you can get from that's maybe, but it's like, I'm not necessarily buying you in these scenes.
What about, because I think the comparison with Glenn Powell would definitely be more one-to-one with Tom Cruise.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Let me not interrupt.
Well, I think that there's movies where Tom Cruise works in brilliantly in when the director knows how to use, but like he's so manufactured that it can come across as very artificial.
Yeah.
But in the hands of a brilliant director, they use that, and they use like whatever is the like root of his artificiality to like. Add to like the insecurity of the character that he's playing, and then it ends up working in the role to its benefit instead of where I think that there's roles where Glenn Powell, like in Hitman, Glenn Powell works a lot better because he is given a excuse in the narrative to be needing to be someone else. So you can kind of hide a little bit of the artificiality of his acting behind the character needing to play a role. And then he comes across as a really perfect fit for that role. But in other versions where it's just meant to be genuine anger, yeah, it's not coming across like a Hackman actually chewing you out and disappointed in you or like blowing his lid. It comes across as more as somebody who like is trying to communicate to you through their facial expressions that they're angry now.
I think that's a strong analysis. I absolutely agree, because they're like Top Gun Maverick. I didn't love him in, but I thought he was much more fitting in that role than I'm seeing him here. I'm not sure what your take on Twister was, but
he plays the cocky kind of. It's interesting. I think it's a pretty boring narrative for a movie in general, but his performance was adequate. He kind of does the like love interest of a. I don't know. He plays a good love interest in that movie, I guess. Like, I wouldn't want to watch him as the main character, but they very smartly put him as somebody who's in the majority of the movie, but not so much that you need to empathize with him.
Like Sean mentioned, you know, he has a strong jaw, definitely leading man quality. I'm finding some of the takes or some of his, you know, performance style to be a little unconvincing. But there's a part of the artificiality that works for the superficiality of the show that we're presented here. Mm-hmm. And there's a bit of, like, playing up the heightened nature of all this. Like I said, Coleman Domingo and Josh Brolin are really hamming it up. So there's a bit to where it's like we're all doing, like, Frank Miller, Sin City, heightened, you know, performance art that I like a lot. But I'm from him... And even more intimate, there's intimate scenes in here where he has to say, and we'll end it here with his counterpart, Jamie Lawson. Jamie herself was in Sinners a little earlier this year. She played, I think it was Carlton's love interest. There's a part in this film where he has to confide in her that he's joined the show. And her reaction shot to him confiding that is like what Oscar Gold is made out of. And it's going to go like criminally underrepresented because this is smack dab in the middle of a heightened action comedy. But she really like her one reaction to that news hit me on a like watching an actor sort of emote on a greater scale than anything Pal did in this film. So it's hard to quantify. I would say this is a strong recommend for me. I think the tone was brutal. I think it's really funny. I think the production is incredibly slick. And the story will keep you engaged for the entirety of the runtime. I just think that I was having a little trouble with kind of engaging with Glenn Powell as a leading man in the main act in this one.
Trying to figure out if we can do a double feature where I make you watch the 87 version and you make me watch the Edgar Wright version.
Oh, yeah? You love the 87 version that much, huh?
I mean, it's definitely a movie I know like the back of my hand because I've watched it. So that's my dad's fault more than the fact that I loved it so much.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, we could do it. I can see us swapping off. I wouldn't hate to watch it again. So let's put it. Yeah, if we wanted to do a double feature.
Also weird. I didn't realize that what's her name is also in the Batman. She's the mayor.
Oh, she was the mayor. I forgot about that.
Jamie Lawson. Yeah.
I completely forgot about
that. Totally didn't think. I was reading through her credits. And I was like, oh, fuck, she was the mayor.
I'm not the biggest fan of the Batman either. So that's kind of why. This may be a good transition.
When did you?
I've never been a huge fan of Batman. We've talked about this. Remember, we talked about this in a comics corner. Almost a year ago, we're up to 23 episodes.
I repress it so that I can respect your opinion more.
I brought it up during Penguin, and when we were covering Penguin, I was like, I went back to watch the Batman.
Right, I remember now.
And then I sort of reassessed
myself. I remember.
I've never been
mad that you're mad that he walks into shots. I remember this now.
Yeah, the way.
A lot of other things. I'm being reductive to be an asshole, but yeah.
But it's But that's a perfect transition into our comics corner.
A perfect transition into comics corner.
So Martian Manhunter feels relevant to any time period. That's part of the beauty of the character. So why tell this story as a Martian Manhunter story, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's to me, the book is very rooted in today. It is very rooted into the things that I'm concerned about or that I'm seeing around me. So it felt like the right time to tell a book about empathy and difficulty communicating and anger and social instability. But then it was also, it really was born from the character. I saw all these different elements that I really liked, the mind reading, the alien, the idea of an alien masquerading as a person. I just felt like there was the whole fire motif. I wanted to work that in. So it really was born from, yes, the character, a lot of other stuff that I love reading that's not in comics. And then, yeah, most of all the world around me right now. And so if it feels like it's timeless, which is what we're going for, it's because we're always kind of struggling, I think, with a lot of the same issues. They're different each time. The manifestations are different each time, but we're fundamentally struggling with kind of the same things as we have been for centuries and millennia. So,
for sure. And so, Javier, I've loved your work since you were working on Daredevil with Mark Waid. Wow. And something that I noticed, like, with your art then was that it was very, you know, rigid. There's lots of structure because, I mean, that speaks to Daredevil as a character specifically. But with this book, you're much more abstract, you know, going along with the fact that it's an abstract concept, really, that we're dealing with here. And you've really switched up, like, your forms. Was this, like, another drawing style that you were just wanting to try out?
No, you know, from sometime to now, I'm more interested in just now. I think it's my personal opinion that comics are taking a lot from cinema, especially from last year. So I'm more interested to back the view to art in general, to graphic design, you know, to work with the space rather than movies, rather than TV series that I think in the last years is the biggest inspiration for comics. I want to take back this graphic aspect, you know, the 2D influence in the comics and in real life. So I think putting all that together is a new view. Could be.
Show what's possible with the medium, with our medium, yeah.
All right, that was from whatever he scrounged up for a trailer for Comics Corner. what I wanted to talk about today, we mentioned last time we did Comics Corner, I absolutely fucking airballed. And when the announcement came that Absolute Martian Manhunter had a definitive end date, for some reason my brain took that as I have read the last issue and this is where it ended. But no, turns out that we're on issue 10, we're going to 12, so we got two yet unreleased. So I wanted to talk about 9 and 10 here, which is, you know, me catching up. Are you caught up on Absolute Martian Manhunter?
No, I'm 9 and 10 are where I need to catch up as well.
Okay, so this take on Absolute, or on Martian Manhunter in this Absolute universe is, Martian is more of a descriptor of just an alien idea. Like, they are not Martian in that they are from Mars, but they're Martian in that they are something non-human, and that's just the word that they kind of latched onto. And in the run in general, if you haven't been listening to Comics Corner or following the Absolute Universe, the Absolute Martian Manhunter has been particularly psychedelic, whereas the Absolute Universe as a whole has been this kind of, like, brutal, darker. Like, everybody's going through a little bit more fucked up version of the mainline DC story. Absolute Martian Manhunter, instead of being a Martian who has a alter ego on Earth, it's told through John Jones, which, weird, not the UFC fighter, but the alter ego, it's an FBI agent that is... some, like, sort of possessed, sort of haunted, sort of maybe being driven crazy by this metaphor for an idea that is living in his head that calls itself the Green Martian. And it's sort of doing a almost like Green Lantern thing, where there's different colors of Martians that are representing different ideas, and it's like ideas, like concepts made flesh, not even concepts made flesh, which is something that we've seen somewhat in other media, but it's like a concept still staying a concept, but interacting with the material world. Yeah. In a very strange way. So it's like driving the main character a little bit insane as he sees these like psychedelic versions where he's looking at the like a core emotions and concepts that are doing battle in the like metaphysical realm. It's very psychedelic, very, very interesting. The visuals are absolutely stunning, but in the more recent episodes, it kind of digs into, I said episodes instead of issues, but it digs into that idea of them being a metaphor. They decide to like take a night off where he's like, I just need you out of my brain for a night. Like, I just need a moment to relax. And so they separate, and in that separation, they're vulnerable to isolation. And so they kind of get picked off. And it kind of goes from there. So there was a little bit of, they get into like America as an idea. There's a couple like antagonistic characters that get introduced that are sort of representations of American ideals that are doing battle with the Green Martian. And it's just so, it could get so pretentious and so like kind of just like hard to follow, but the visuals, what'd you say?
Could get.
I mean, it definitely is. But it's just so compelling, like visually, that it rewards you kind of poring over the pages. So the density and like opaqueness of the text itself just serves as like an additional feature, because it just gives you more time to just bathe in the colors that they're giving you, which are just phenomenal.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful book.
It's gorgeous book.
Really gorgeous book. I want to, yeah, second, I think, I mean, I know I'm not even, I'm not saying this in a judgmental way, but even the spiel on covering it is hard. It's difficult to follow, like, if you're not necessarily reading the text. But what McGee said is book accurate. It's these really strange concepts entering the flesh, the metaphysical world, and fighting one another in interesting ways. I struggle with the lack of assertiveness of the character and some of the, like you mentioned, the opaqueness of the plot. And I think at times, like, we're 10 books in and I feel like we're not much further with the character. And I should say I'm on book 8, so maybe 9 and 10 kind of pushes a little. And I know they have plans on the Martian uniting the universe. And I think maybe that's what the opaqueness is about, in a way, of he's not in some way telling us that this is going to be the Legion of Doom. We're in some way going to connect, you know, Batman, Wonder Woman, Superman, and create the Legion of Doom to go up against the Justice League. That's the turn on this book of characters. So I want to feel maybe we're holding back a little bit to see how these other books are going to line up there. But I think in times being told constantly by the Martian, you will not understand, blah, 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 blah. It gets difficult as a reader to like, come on, my guy, you gotta tell us a little something about what's going on here, why you're here. And that sort of really quick, that push and pull was what was like a little, like, as beautiful as I like the pages, I do still want the story to kind of lock in as well, and I think that's where I was having a little bit of the issue. But I'm his minor spoilers, his son becoming much more involved, it feels like, in these next two issues.
Yeah,
feels like it's going to be a really, it's going to go in the places maybe that I'm looking forward to go in. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I'm kind of guessing.
So not I don't want to discourage, like, 9 is not going to encourage you, but I feel like 10 lands the plane a little bit, and we haven't even touched the sun.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
The sun is still there. He's still, you know, kind of, they're still building him up. I feel like 11 is where it's gonna peak with him, and then 12 is obviously gonna be the finale. So they're still laying the groundwork for it, but that hasn't really paid off,
right?
As of yet. At 9, I was kind of in the same boat where I was like, guys, we got to kind of wrap things up here. You got to make clear what's going on.
Right.
And then by the end of 10, I was just kind of like, I'll just full on, fuck yeah, let's go. Like, nice. Can't wait to see how 11 and 12 land this plane. So
yeah.
if you're, you know, interested in that sort of like psychedelic visual feast in and taking a dive into something that is like narratively, I don't know, opaque, like you said, I'd definitely recommend it as a book to check out.
Hell yeah. Yeah, it I shouldn't 100% behind
and
the
just
and
I like
book.
The finite a finish line. So yeah, that was Absolute Martian Manhunter. This is written by Denise Camp, illustrated by Javier Rodriguez. The first collection I have on my shelf, absolutely worth checking out. And the last two wrapping up this run are coming out in, I guess May and June, right?
Wrapping up this summer? Hell yeah.
Yeah, wrapping up this summer.
All right. And we're going to move on to our last little bit. This is an Absolute Batman stop motion short film. It'll be in the show notes coming up after this.
Shred it!
Wait!
All right, so that was from the little stop-motion short. Here's a log line. This is a full stop-motion animation recreation of the fight between Batman and the party animals in the issue one of Absolute Batman. One of his favorite issues from Absolute Batman and the reason why this creator got started collecting DC comics again. If you haven't read Absolute Batman yet, he does recommend you do so. And I didn't get the name.
As do we.
Yeah, hell yeah. And I didn't get the name exactly, but the production company is Dang It Productions. When he lists the credits, for the voice actor, he does Batman and he says me. So I'm gonna need you to get it together, bro, in terms of like listing the credits and who is all involved here. Because I want to credit, rightfully credit who's involved with this work. Because I thought it was fantastic. Now, is it a little? Does some of the sound design leave something to be desired? Does some of the animation feel like at least, yeah, you know, he didn't have the budget you would put together,
yeah,
if you were actually given to do something like this. But
is the accent choice for Alfred a little bit wild?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. But I think the heart
is he just doing Butcher from The Boys a little bit? Yeah.
I think the heart of this short is what's most important to gravitate to, because I think when we get here in terms of the fandom, it really says something about how your characters and whatnot have really lived with the populace. And what's so interesting is I remember seeing, you know, a year or so ago, the first image for the Absolute Batman comic and just thinking, that looks ridiculous. I don't like that. I'm not really sure I'll be engaged in this book, to where we are a whole year later where people are spending their hard time and money to create a stop motion animation of just the first scene or one of the party animal fights in this one. I don't see there ever being a big budget studio effort to, you know, realize the absolute, you know, universe in any kind of, you know, real way. But I think maybe a DC animated original maybe is not off the table. And them putting a little bit of money into something like that. And to part of the fun thing for me about reading comics is how would you do that? How would you do this? Blah, blah, blah. And I think him imagining this and how do the Batman tendrils move on a very basic level and just seeing this character in 3D space kind of move around and function to be really, really kind of fun. And it's not necessarily, what am I trying to say? I want to cheerlead, highlight, give the roses to Jurgada and Snyder, because that was the pull that they made with this book. And the creator of this stop motion short mentions it in his log line, and just like it really invigorated a certain base of the fandom that hadn't read in a while or were a little off on the books. Like they really did something special here with this idea and the collaborators involved. So to see it get to this point to where people are like, I'm gonna shoot 1300 frames for this project because I love this so much, is a testament to you guys did something here. You guys pulled it off in a way where I'm like, I'm enjoying reading these books a lot. We just got the introduction of the Robins in the absolute continuity for this one, which is a really interesting take for that. So I just want to, seeing this kind of brought a certain like light to my eye, like, wow, you saw created. I've mentioned, I put it somewhere in the little comics corners introductions, where hearing Scott talk about like how nervous he was and how he was trying to get other people to do it and saying like, well, what if Batman's this and that? And again, it's not that we haven't seen year one tells a very similar story of Batman in poverty and becoming, you know, Batman we know. So it's not, it was an unheard of conceit, but the lengths in which they've taken it and how it's invigorated the fan base and how people are responding to this built, like, I don't know if you've seen the people in their Comic-Con, like cosplay, like dressing up and creating little costumes of this or miniatures of this. This stop motion film here. She's been really exciting to be, you know, a part of the absolute Batman fandom. And then a book that I initially was 100% like, I hate that drawing. To where I'm just like, oh my God, I can't wait for this next episode next month, or the next issue. I'm doing the episode thing now. I can't wait for the next issue next month or whatever. It's been really a fun time. So keep going with it. And have you seen this fandom turn into things in the past? Like, I don't know if you remember the 2010 Mortal Kombat Rebirth short Michael J. White was a part of. I strongly believe that led to where we got to with Mortal Kombat now. Not that I'm a huge fan of those films, but yeah, kind of reinvite. Like, so we're seeing Dan Trachtenberg with Portal, kind of putting his love and effort into something that he loved a lot or stuff like that, and where his career has gone. I'm like, I'm not saying this guy's gonna run Leica or something like that in the next few years.
But I mean, I bet he could at least get a previz job. Yeah. Like, this could get his foot in the door for doing some previz for a studio. Hell absolutely. But I think one of the interesting things with the, like, what DC's doing in film in general, like with the Batman spinning off into like Penguin and Clayface, then, you know, we're like trying to establish like the larger continuity, but like still leaving room for like, man, if you got a story to tell, fucking tell it. And like, that's a cool creative space to be in, and that's what makes you excited. Like, New 52 didn't inspire this sort of
that's
you
a
know
perfect example. That is absolutely
where there's a difference between like doing something out of desperation, which is like what it feels like the mode that like Star Wars and Marvel is in, where they're like, we're withering and dying, like we need to reboot in order to reinvigorate interest. Whereas this feels like something where it's like, no, like tell the story you want to tell and like it'll be the right time for it. Like, if you need to reboot it in a different spinoff universe, do that. If it's connected to something we've already done, hell yeah. Right. Like, you know, like just do what works, you know, and that's a, like, just creatively fulfilling, and it makes it more exciting to read at the same time. Cause you're like, if I want it to be connected, I can go for those kind of stories. If I want something standalone, if I'm that kind of fan, like that's available for me too. And it's just nice to have, to be able to meet it in its own place and meet your audience with whatever they're wanting to consume it as.
Oh, yeah. And I'm hoping Scott and Dragotta keep meeting us with more books. And even if it's this project moving on, is, you know, whatever they do, I think it's just been this creative fervor that it's sort of generated in the audience. It's just like, wow, you know, kudos to you.
That's
guys.
What I'm
tip of the hat to you.
I'm sure I brought this up. Well, sorry, I didn't mean
to. Oh, no, I'm just saying tip of the hat to Snyder and Dragotta. Like,
absolutely. I know I've probably brought it up on the pod before, but it reminds me of one of my favorite bits that Branson Reese talks about with Rude Tales of Magic, which is like a D&D live, or like, what is it, real play podcast, whatever. He talks about like his favorite fan response to like anything he puts out is bad fan art, because it's like the idea that somebody who doesn't have the technical skill but was so inspired by what you made that they needed to put pen to paper anyway is the coolest thing possible. Yeah. So it's like not that this stop motion was bad at all, because I thought it was like you said, there's criticisms to be made, but like
right.
only
the spirit, the heart,
constructive. There's yeah. constructive criticism to be made because it's like, oh, I see what you're doing, and I want you to keep doing it.
Right.
And like that's a cool place to be, both as a creator and as a fan. And it's just like exactly what you want out of an art form that's like, you know, going to live on and inspire more people forever.
For sure. All right, so that was the Comics Corner. Be sure and check out the short film in the show notes. It's a really fun little 8 minutes. And we're moving on to our theme for May. Here we go. So theme for next this month, All Work No Play in May, where work becomes obsession. So characters in their workplace and they're sort of spiraling out of control or things of that nature, people suffering in the workplace, suffering in their 9-to-5, suffering making contact, suffering being the man that wasn't there. These are things that happen in the month of May. So next week we are covering Contact, starring Jodie Foster. A great film. I actually really, really enjoyed this one. I think it's going to be a fun film to break down.
Looks like Contact's available for streaming on MGM Plus if you have a subscription. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's available from the, you know, standard rent or purchase digital options. Hell yeah, I'm looking forward to it for sure. It's a movie that I watched so young. Like I remember watching this as a fucking wee lad, and so it, like revisiting it now,
it's a
really interesting experience.
I said you and Denis Villeneuve.
Oh yeah, I didn't know you. Well, I guess we'll talk about it next week. Oh yeah, Arrival. Yeah. Arrival's a pretty obvious. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, all right, covering it next
I thought
week.
Maybe he mentioned it in an interview or something.
Man. Yeah, we're off with the jokes today.
Jesus Christ, yeah.
Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplybox, theme song by Soulspy. Coming soon, folks.